Before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to let you know about a powerful free resource for Lent. It's a devotional excerpt from Lent and Easter for Everyone by N.T. Wright, featuring daily scripture reflections for a week to guide you from the wilderness to the wonder of Easter. Whether you observe Lent every year or you're just exploring it for the first time, this short devotional will help you slow down and grow in wisdom this season. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now on to the show.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
Good morning, here from Aylesbury High School, and welcome to another episode of Premier Unbelievable. I'm so excited to be joined by two wonderful guests who I've got to know and I've got a lot of affection for, great philosophers here, one from Oxford, one from Cambridge, and we're surrounded by some great students here at Aylesbury High School, a wonderful school that's been a friend to Unbelievable over the years, and we've had a lot of great debates here. Today we are discussing the question, are we free? Are we really free? The free will debate is happening here, and we're going to be looking at everything from moral agency, personhood, identity, justice, everything that comes with that. It's a massive, massive topic, but we've got two wonderful guests to help unpack that for us. So I'd like to invite you to introduce yourselves. To my left, who are you? Where do you come from?
Hello, my name is Matthew Su. I'm from New Zealand, and I'm studying a PhD in philosophy of religion at Cambridge.
Thank you very much, Matthew Su. And to my right.
Hello, I'm Amna Wisdom. I'm a moral philosopher, as my areas of research include philosophy of mind and more specifically philosophy of emotions.
Excellent. Two former friends of Unbelievable who've been on this before. As we start, let's just set the table of why this really matters. Amna, could you please unpack for us why this question matters and what all the consequences are of the free will debate?
You know, Sam, that is such an important question. And sometimes, if not often, it is really overlooked that there are two important considerations that we have to take into account before we take positions in this debate. And I'm referring particularly to the young people like you who haven't reasonably made up your minds about what do you think we have, you know, whether you think the true free will exists. You know, the first consideration is obviously why it matters. You know, why is it important that we are free or otherwise determined? And the second related question is about knowledge. You know, how do we know that we are free? What makes it the case that our justified beliefs qualify as knowledge? So these are two interrelated questions. And on the knowledge issue question, philosophers in the past have been, some philosophers have been very radically, in fact, skeptical about whether we can know anything. A radical skeptic, according to radical skepticism, we should suspend our judgment and acquire some kind of peace of mind or ataraxia. Why? Because what matters is really, you know, not to be bothered and troubled intellectually and practically about these issues. What matters is to be happy. Now, given that these kind of debates are very much live, continue to be live today, it just really confirms the point that we as human beings are intellectually curious. You know, we want to satisfy this intellectual curiosity. And sometimes this curiosity leads to actions. Now, human beings have done good and bad things just because they can, you know, out of curiosity. And philosophers traditionally have a very good answer to these cautionary notes, because they say, well, you know, we should pursue knowledge for the sake of knowledge, because knowledge is valuable in itself. And I'm mentioning this because whilst this is a kind of nice point of gravitas, nice kind of starting position to hold when we are debating and forming judgments about whether we're free, it is sometimes forgotten. You know, it is, you know, this kind of very noble inquiry, a knowledge inquiry, kind of gets sidelined, or, you know, people pursue these questions and debates for all sorts of reasons. And you can see it in the public domains. You know, there are some popular positions that attract attention. You can think of, you know, some YouTubers and the subscriptions of going to 100,000, and not necessarily for the good reason, because the popular views could be popular because they are controversial. And I'm not gonna, sort of point at determinism only, but yes, you know, so some kind of, you know, we are determined, we don't have free will. That sounds fascinating, dazzling. So what is important in this context, I think, is to carefully reflect on the behalf of those who make these claims, as well as those who subscribe to these views. It's important to reflect, why does it matter that, you know, this claim is true, if it's true? And why does it matter that, you know, we are so determined to pursue these claims? You know, is there something in this dazzling logical argument that we need to question? You know, it may be logical, but there could be some, you know, premises that are false that we need to be really carefully unpacking and critically evaluating. So, sorry, Sam, kind of, I keep...
No, that's great. We've unpacked a lot there. Let's there's a lot there that we'll be getting into in this discussion. Let's first define our terms. So I'll turn to you, Matthew, to be the dictionary for this part. We've mentioned terms like determinism. Mm-hmm. There's also important terms like compatibilism, right. Libertarian free will. Could you explain the kind of positions here? And then I'm sure many of our guests in the audience will start thinking about where they land on some of these things.
Okay. So let's see. So I think two pieces of important vocab that is important to master for this debate are firstly the difference between libertarianism and, I guess, determinism, right? These are two terms that come together, libertarianism and determinism. And second, compatibilism and incompatibilism, right? Let me explain. So libertarianism is the position on free will, which typically says, in order to be free, I must be able to choose between different possibilities, right? Whereas if you are a determinist, you think that, and if you're a libertarian, you think that there are these possibilities and that I can choose between them. If you're a determinist, you say that, you know, there are no alternate possibilities, and, you know, therefore you can't choose between them. That's libertarianism and determinism. The compatibilists will say that even if you are determined to act, even if there's only one way that things could be, you can still be free, right? So freedom is compatible with determinism, compatibilism. Other people will disagree, and they will say, well, if determinism is true, if there is only one way that things could be, then nobody is free, right? And those are incompatibilists. Now, if you're an incompatibilist, you can... be of the determinist variety. So you can say, I'm an incompatibilist. I don't think free will is compatible with determinism. Determinism is true. Therefore, there is no free will. Or you can say, you know, I think free will is incompatible with determinism. Determinism is false. Therefore, we do have free will, right? So there's two different ways of getting incompatibilists. And I think that that's the term.
That's very well explained for us. It seems to me extremely instinctive that I have free will, that I am able to make my own choices, that I am my own person with my own tastes, likes, dislikes, and my own experiences. It seems on the surface to be the most self-evident thing that one could find out about themselves and about the world. And yet when we dig into some science, in particular some psychology, questions raise as to how free we actually are to make some of our decisions. So could you explain to me the position that you take and maybe explain why you take that position?
Okay, sure. My position is that free will is the kind of freedom that is necessary for rational action. And I think that this matters. I think that this matters to carry on from what Amna said earlier, because when we learn things about the world, we find that our agency gets lost in all the explanations that we give for our agency, right? Like, I was born this way, society made me this way, God made me this way, etc. The me kind of disappears. But it's just immediately obvious from the fact that we can have conversations, from the fact that we can act in the world, that there is such a thing as rational action. And therefore, you can't, as it were, take me out of the story of the world and still have the world, right? I'm in it. I'm an agent in the world. And this means that, you know, whatever the case happens to be, I obviously am free. And that's sort of my position.
Excellent. Thank you. Amna, over to you. What position do you take and why? And why do you perhaps find some of the other positions not so persuasive?
My position is libertarian. I should just say it's up there. And my intuition, and you mentioned similar intuition early on, is that we have a very strong sense that we are free. And this could be true even if we were not free. Immanuel Kant, for example, would say that we act under the assumption that we're free, regardless of the big metaphysical picture, you know, regardless of whether we actually have alternative possibilities and so on. But my way of thinking is, well, look, it just makes sense to think that freedom or free will entails the possibility that I could act otherwise. So it's one thing to say that I have a good reason for performing this particular action and that I could rationalize, you know, this action, whatever it might be. But quite another thing to say that I chose this action over something else. So I think that's quite crucial to a libertarian type of argument. And there are some problems, as we will discuss it in a minute, with that very position, to do with a, you know, natural world being causally closed and causally structured. But just as a final point, I think that we have access, some kind of metaphysical access to what is true, even when we cannot fully articulate it. You know, so in other words, our intuitions are the faculty that allow us to, you know, to access some fundamental truths about reality around us.
Now, what are some of the problems with determinism? I want to preface this. There's a very famous court case a century ago where legendary attorney Clarence Darrow, who was a defense at the famous Scopes trial a century ago, he managed to get two young men who had committed quite a brutal murder off the death penalty and instead to life imprisonment by arguing that they had absolutely no freedom, that they were completely determined by the forces of nature and society that had guided them. They absolutely could not have done otherwise. They had no choice but to commit this crazy murder. And it was quite a shocking case and set quite a precedent. But could you outline for us why something like that just doesn't fly with you? Why? What is the failing of determinism?
In that particular case, that's just empirical fact. You know, some people just are compelled to do something, or otherwise forced to do something. But that is not really philosophically interesting. What's philosophically interesting is, are all cases like that? You know, are we in all instances of our conduct compelled or forced to do something or caused to do something? And the answer should be, I think, no. You know, sometimes we find ourselves compelled. Some other times we introspectively, you know, we can reflect and think, no, I made the decision. Nobody actually told me to do this. You know, I own this decision and authority over what I've done. So that's I hope that's kind of wrap
it. No, that's very good. It is everything like that. So there might be certain cases where someone was in a position where maybe they couldn't have acted otherwise. We think about sort of diminished responsibility, mm-hmm. perhaps. And in a legal situation, that's very interesting. But we're asking, are all your decisions like that? I filled up this glass of water. Did I have no choice to do that? It couldn't have been otherwise. There was absolutely no force in my power where I couldn't have filled that glass up with water. We're getting into some questions here of moral agency, Matthew. This is a big one when we think about things like justice. Could it have been otherwise? The man that killed a child, was he completely innocent, really, of responsibility? It was just biology plus society made it happen. The man who leaves his wife and children to go and be with someone else, it was just biology driving him. The guy couldn't help but cheat. There was no way it could have been otherwise. Well, obviously, there's a couple of examples there of moral agency. When it comes to free will here, obviously we can see why that matters, but could you sort of broaden the case for us of how this works in terms of free will and moral agency, and what you think are the problems with strict determinism?
Okay, so just recapping the question. You want me to explain the relationship between free will and moral agency?
Yes.
And
then, because you don't believe in determinism yourself,
right?
What are your reasons for rejecting that position?
Yes. Well, so to address the second thing just briefly before I really go into it, I kind of wanted to bring up because I feel like determinism is getting really short shrift. Neither me nor Anna really believe in it.
We'll attack libertarianism in a moment.
Yes. Yeah. So. Okay, great. I am glad. I just don't want to present just one side of the argument, right? So free will is, of course, really important for morality, because free will, you know, if it is just the position that, you know, I own this decision, this is my decision, it becomes really important for the sake of assigning praise and blame, right? Moral responsibility. You can only be morally praised or blamed for something if there was moral agency involved. If you were just being puppeteered into an action by strings, or you were, you know, sleepwalking into it or something, you know, then it would be very difficult to say, well, here is an exercise of moral virtue or of moral decision making, right? Because there was no such decision making involved. And on certain accounts of, you know, what it is to act and be human, which sort of heavily emphasize the inhuman causes of human behavior, it may seem that, you know, human behavior is what philosophers call an epiphenomenon, right? It's an excretion that doesn't play any causal role in the outcome. And if that's the case, if epiphenomenalism about our wills is the case, if we are in the position of, you know, the younger sibling who has a disconnected game controller, he pretends that he's playing, but actually he's not, you know, then, of course, there's a big problem for moral responsibility. Now, why I don't think that we are unfree is because I just don't think you can tell a plausible causal story about the world that says that deliberation never occurs and doesn't matter, right? We are not, in fact, zombies sleepwalking through the world. There is such a thing as rational deliberation about goods on the basis of rational content. You know, if that were impossible, philosophy would be impossible, right? Therefore, I'm very confident that, you know, even if there are processes which are by themselves deterministic, they are incorporated into a system that is overall rational. And yeah, that's why I think we're free.
Excellent. Thank you. Be thinking of some questions you might want to come up with, or some situations. We look forward to getting into that. We'll attack libertarianism a bit here as well. And I do want to bring science into it a little as well, because we're mammals, we're animals. But when my cat kills a mouse, like, it hasn't done anything morally wrong. It's just being a cat. But if a man kills a child, we see that very, very differently. But there's not this massive evolutionary gulf between us, relatively. So how does the science inform questions about free will, and why do we see our behavior as different from maybe other animals?
So methodologically speaking, science has a job to do, and so does philosophy. And these aims do overlap, but they're ultimately not the same aims. So science arguably cannot explain everything. It can explain physical acts about the natural world and causal laws, etc. But a big question is whether science can step beyond these kind of explanatory resources and explain what it is to behave rationally, what it is to make a choice, meaningful action. And as a philosopher, naturally, I would resist that possibility. So yes, science is very important, and I think scientific discoveries should inform empirically minded philosophers so that they revise otherwise too strict conceptual schemes. But it is not to say that science can dictate or exhaustively explain what's going on in this particular context. How do we, critically look at a libertarian position, sufficiently critically? Well, we can think the following. The world is causally structured. We are part of the natural world. So how can we escape this, causality, this structure, and posit something that supervenes on these natural structures? And one way to think about that is to say, well, but perhaps there are layers of causality. So there is something it is to be caused, for a leaf to be caused to blow in the wind. But because we are rational agents, we can arguably affect the outcome, not just the reasons why we pursue certain activities, but the actual outcome. Now, that's the easy part because, I could be more inclined, less inclined than you, some, to recycle, and I could choose to recycle less, and that can in turn impact the global warming and the climate in general. But, how can we say that we can see, the outcome independently of how some, me and Machi and all of you, respond to these challenges of our times? Well, it seems that there is something important about our action that contributes to how things will turn out to be. So that's kind of, like I said, easier part of this puzzle. The more difficult part is, to claim that I really am not caused to recycle less, that I still have, even given the upbringing, all the sort of contingent circumstances to do with my life, even given all these factors and influences, causal influences, that I still have free will to decide, in this case, how much and whether I recycle. So that's the trickiest part for any libertarian, I think, to argue, to pull off.
Yeah, excellent. That's very good. Matthew, I want to interject another anecdote here, which is the illustration that's often used, and I know Alex O'Connor's made it quite popular as well, of the judges. So apparently, if someone is having a court hearing in the late morning, they're more likely to be judged as guilty because the judge is hungry. This is a real thing, apparently.
Yeah.
The magistrate is hungrier, so they're grumpier, so they're more eager to get out of there, so you get more guilty verdicts. Now, I have a friend who's a magistrate, and I told them this, and they laughed. They're like, no, we always have plenty of biscuits kind of in a plate in front of us. That's never happened. But it is data still. So what do you make of that? And also, are there any other criticisms of the complete libertarian, you're as free as you could possibly be, position?
That's very funny. And of course, there are lots of things that do influence our decisions which aren't rational, right? Even if it was the case, that wouldn't really affect my basis for believing in free will, because you know, I think that the basis of free will is rational decision-making. And it can't be argued that the judge was, you know, somnambulating his way through the case, right? He wasn't asleep when he was giving his judgment. He was making it on the basis of particular legal determinations. These can be reconstructed and they can be appealed if he does it. So, you know, like all these kinds of rational considerations, I think it's not just, so the question for the person who denies free will is not just, ooh, can you point to influences, right? Anyone can point to influences that influence decisions. You know, that's just how we are in the world. If you want to say that these influences mean we have no free will, that's a huge additional leap to make. And I think the leap is almost impossible to make because you'd have to deny that we're rational, and that's just not plausible. But as for serious challenges to free will, I think that you know, one thing that really gets up, that gets brought up in a sort of hard scientific context is the infamous Libet experiments in free will.
I'm familiar with them, but do unpack them for the audience.
Well, so I am, I confess, not a master of the precise details, but the sort of upshot is that they ran an experiment which basically had a person sitting there and they gave him a task, like randomly decide when you're going to raise your arm or something trivial like that. And they always found that prior to his consciously being aware of his making the decision to raise his arm, right, there was a kind of biological going on, some action potential or whatever that started sparking before he started moving. And they said, oh, well, there goes free will, right? We've seen that even the freest and most inconsequential of decisions, deciding whether to raise your arm, is preceded and therefore controlled by biological mechanisms, right? So we've empirically disproved free will is basically the idea. You wanted me to explain it, and do you want me to explain what?
Explain what's wrong with that.
Yes, well, okay.
About it.
Yeah, well, so what's really interesting about this is it purports to show us that, you know, we are in fact an epiphenomenon, right? We are in fact just smoke being blown out of the factory while the factory just produces what it wills anyway. But I think that's actually quite not a very good test case for at least what I think matters about free will. So as I said, what I think matters in free will is rational agency, right? And deciding whether or not to lift your arm randomly, you know, it's just the sort of thing that you would outsource to your body, right? It's not really where rational agency really lives. Rational agency is a diachronic process. It occurs over time, right? It occurs in real world contexts. It occurs in evaluative contexts. Now, it's very easy to say, you know, this particular biological action potential preceded my raising my arm. It's very difficult to say that my composing my essay was based on, you know, this random biological action potential. So, yes, I just don't think it's analyzing the case at the right level, which brings me to a very important component of how we can think about free will fitting into the world, right? When we look at the sciences, we see that in the sciences, there are levels of explanation. There's the underlying physical level of explanation, of course, but the biological level of explanation has more information in it than just at the physical, right? You can't explain why the fox hunts without reference to explicitly biological concepts, not just physical concepts. And this occurs at higher levels of psychology and ultimately at the level of reason, right? So it's not like free will is this magical thing that is in conflict with everything else. You know, if you think of the world as consisting in these many different levels of cooperating explanations, free will is, you know, one level of this explanation. And in my view, it fits quite well. We don't need to violate causal closure of the physical or any doctrine like that.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Before we get to questions, because you've been on a couple of debates here about AI, and I thought this is maybe a nice way of framing this. In philosophy, we use terms like zombies and robots. We use analogies. Perhaps my biggest issue with the free will question is not moral agency, it's personhood. Why am I not a zombie? Why am I not a robot? And when we think about AI, arguments about can machines think? Can AI ever become sentient? Are the Terminator movies going to become real life? You know, we think about, we can think of humans in terms of robots, maybe with a little bit of free will sprinkled on top of them or something. But I'd love you to speak into that in whichever way you like. But free will is so intrinsically important in terms of what makes us who we are as persons. And the risk with a completely extreme skeptical position is that maybe personhood gets lost. You are just the byproduct of processes and environment. So what do you make of that? And what assurance can you give us in this room that we're not zombies or just enhanced robots?
In short, introspection. You know, introspectively, that you're alive, that you have body, that you can think. And I think it cannot be better reassurance than that. You don't need to be argued, reasoned into thinking that you are a person. These are things that are obviously true from a first personal perspective. I can't say really at this point. I mean, I had to think about the complexity of the challenge you unpacked here. But I can't think of any better reason of thinking that we are not zombies, that we are, we are persons. And zombies is, this kind of thought experiment conducted by somebody called Chalmers. It is about the possibility that, zombies can function in the same way that humans can, and then we cannot tell the difference. I'm not going to sort of critically assess this very thought experiment, but if we are assigning personhood and free will to too many entities, that seems to be not a very good place to be in. We have to kind of perhaps think in terms of, in terms of the possibility that some entities are just machines, some entities are just always going to be machines, including social robots, that they will never be able to feel, make rational decisions and so on. And there is a lot of resistance, to this kind of idea, because the way that these technological developments are going suggests that one day, I might be wrong, and so be it. But as it stands, I think that we can confidently claim that, we are persons, we have free will, and then the robots, the artificial intelligence, is just extension. The algorithms we put in these machines are just extensions of our free will to do whatever we do with these entities.
So it's more like a mirror kind of reflecting life and thought back at you rather than anything independent itself. Very interesting question I want to just throw on top of that as well. Is my cat free? Because my cat seems to have quite a personality and a character and an attitude and a lot of affection. Is a cat free in a way that I'm free? Is it levels of organization? Is it hierarchical? Just a bonus question for you there.
Well, I think Matthew perhaps has a lot to say.
Matthew, maybe you can tell me whether or not my cat is free, like I'm free.
Oh, well said. No, but also more so. When you ask whether your cat is free, you could be asking two questions here. So the first question, would be the one that I would be interested in. Is your cat a rational agent and free in the sense that a rational agent is free? I don't think so. I don't think your cat is rational. Your cat, unfortunately, cannot speak, which is the surest sign of rationality.
It talks a lot, actually. Getting him to shut up is the problem.
Maybe we should have a conversation. I'll change my mind. But yes, so your cat isn't rational, so it doesn't have the degree of freedom proper to a rational agent. But I also don't think your cat is just a puppet of, say, molecular forces or physics, right? A cat has its own biological interests. It has its own cat psychology. And the explanations at the level of biology and cat psychology are not reducible. You can't just replace them with physical explanations. So in that sense, your cat is free of the underlying physical structure of the world. There is a catless, a law of what it is to be a cat that properly governs its activities and so forth and makes it cat free, neither rational free nor a slave to physics, but free as a cat.
cat-free. You've learned a new term today for your exams. I think my cat's probably more akin to the hungry judge, perhaps, is a good way of categorizing it. We've had a whistle-stop tour of loads of topics that we've not had the time to get into massive depth about. We've been through some moral agency, some personhood, libertarianism, determinism. Really looking forward to your questions. And just remember before you ask them that you had no choice about the question you're going to ask. You couldn't have asked another question than the one you're going to ask or not. And there is no possible universe where you asked a different question. Okay, Matthew, Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve, and eating the fruit and disobeying God, bringing about the fall, were they free or not? What's your thoughts on that?
My view is that they're free, and not only free, right, but even more free than we are. They were created, according to Christian theology, in a state of what's called original justice. So they not only had our normal level of rationality, they were blessed by friendship with God. So they had every possible intellectual advantage that's possible for a finite human being to have, and yet they abused that freedom, right? And this actually raises a really interesting question, right? Are you more free when you're doing good, or are you less free? And I would say, actually, that you are more free when you are doing good, even if doing good's your only option, versus when you're not. When you're oscillating between good and bad, you're like a drunken person sort of swaying from one side of the road to the other, right? That's not freedom. You're not in control. You're not pursuing your real interests. So why did Adam and Eve nevertheless fall? Well, theologically, I would say it's because, however many advantages you have, the good that was set before them, which is the good of pursuing God, is something that is beyond their understanding and will sort of automatically. You can't automatically conceive of what it is that you're pursuing. You can't, you have to commit an act of trust that goes beyond your understanding in order to pursue those goods. And so that is a real choice, right, between the good that is in front of you but lesser versus the good that is beyond you, but supposedly greater. And that's what the serpent sort of preyed on. And that's the kind of decision that really is indeterminate, even for a fully rational being. And so that's why they were sort of able to make the choice either to go to succeed or to fall. And that's, a little bit of theology on top of our philosophy.
That's great. Fantastic question. And we haven't gone into religion too much here, but obviously with debates over Calvinism versus Arminianism, you've got positions in Christianity where you are so radically free, and then positions where God is in control of everything. Obviously in Islam, everything is controlled. You're not free at all. Everything has been determined. So we've got a full spectrum of positions here if you want to ask questions about religion. Amna, was there anything you wanted to add to that, or should we go to the next question?
No, I'm happy to go.
Are we really truly free when the law restricts our actions and our movements? How does that constraint affect our free will?
So I think we can agree that our actions are constrained by external factors such as laws. And so we can't do everything we want to do. But given these restrictions, that still leaves us with that space. The rational space of deciding between the two actions. And just to kind of the thought occurs, I don't know if you heard about Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre. So he was a philosopher and writer, and in this book called The Wall, he says, and one day I woke up, I was 40, in the prison, and I realized that I can choose which side of the bed to turn in my prison. So that's just an illustration of the fact that even though we could be very restricted in terms of what we can do, we can still make a choices within these restrictions. I don't know if that kind of satisfies your question, answers your question.
So just a brief add to that. So not only are laws sort of boundaries on our agency, in many ways, they actually increase our agency, right? So think again of the drunkard. So the drunkard has fewer constraints upon his behavior. So he wobbles up and down the road, in a very crooked way and doesn't know how to get home, right? That, in my view, would not be free. That's not a guy who has rational agency. whereas laws which guide you, which tell you, you know, where to go and rule out the stupidest options, right? They actually make you more able to rationally pursue your good, and to that extent, make you more able to be free. And this is, in fact, you know, one of the core constraints on designing good law. So that's another relevance of free will. How do we make people, how do we design laws to make people as free as they can be?
Excellent point. Thank you. Outstanding question. Next question. Yeah, what about temptation? Who would like to take that first? The temptation of the chocolate biscuit.
Well,
in the courtroom.
I'm tempted by that question.
Okay.
Okay. So temptation is an interesting one. So I think things are tempting insofar as we sense them to be, in some sense, good for us, right? And, being very complex beings, we have lots of desires and lots of needs, and lots of things are good for us in various sorts of ways. But, you know, our appetites are stupid. They don't take into account our overall good. So it's the job of reason to decide between the goods which the appetite presents to us. So, being presented with objects of appetite then, which just is what it is to be tempted, is not contrary to freedom, because it's part of freedom. Freedom is precisely selecting from between goods which the appetite presents to us. Now, of course, when we talk about temptation, we typically mean where something that the appetite presents to us, so say, you know, delicious food, conflicts with wanting to get thin for summer or something, right? That we sort of know intellectually. It is, as I said, the job of reason to choose the rational good or not. And, you know, Aristotle had a famous explanation of why we don't often do this, which I think is more or less correct, that we lack the power. We haven't cultivated the habit and the virtue enough to always choose the right over the wrong. But yeah, it's not, as I said, temptation is not contrary to freedom. It's part of the process.
I'd like to branch a question off that, which we haven't really broached here, and I wonder if you could tackle it for us, Amna. Mental illness and physical impairments. There's a lot of famous examples in philosophy of mind. You think of the man who had an accident where a pole went through his head and his behavior changed. And for those of us who've been through depression and things like that, it seems like our behavior changes in ways that we can't always control. Could you speak into like physical impairments and free will and what that means for us? Sorry, in a minute or two.
Physical impairments and free will.
Yes.
I think my view, and it says something that is related to that very case of physical impairment, is that sometimes limitations, whether there are physical limitations or socially induced limitations, such as laws, make us even more determined to pursue, you know, something autonomously, to do something that otherwise we would have been less inclined to do. And I think there are plenty of illustrations of that fact that physical impairments, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, scientists like Dawkins, in other words, they push people even harder to achieve certain goals that otherwise people just maybe not be achieving or pursuing even. I don't know if that's kind of
being... No, yeah, that's good. It's such a massive topic to get into. Matthew, if God or a higher power knows what you're going to do tomorrow, did you really have free will to do it?
Yes. So to answer your question, the short answer is yes, and here's why. God knowing what you will do the fancy philosophical word is underdetermines whether you are the explanation of what he knows, right? So, you know, if God knows what you're going to do tomorrow, that might imply that, well, he knows this because he's pulling your strings and he's going to make you do it tomorrow, in which case, you know, perhaps you wouldn't be free. But on the other hand, perhaps the reason why he knows what you're going to do tomorrow is that your deeds tomorrow are the explanation of what he knows, right, to some extent. And if the second thing is the case, then your freedom, the explanation of your behavior would still be intrinsic to you, and therefore your agency would be explanatory of the ultimate result rather than God's foreknowledge. So, just the fact that God knows what you're going to do tomorrow does not imply that you do not have free will.
Excellent. Very good. Great question. I think we've got time for another question. Does your level of freedom depend on your place in the social hierarchy? So if you're a king or a ruler compared to a peasant, is your level of free will in many senses determined by your social status? So I'll give that to you first, Amna.
Well, perhaps what we should be thinking about here is the distinction between being powerful and therefore influencing others on the one hand, and having a free will to autonomously react to what is otherwise imposed on you. I think these are really, you know, two really different issues and questions. So, you know, being higher on that kind of hierarchy, social hierarchy, does not really make you more or less free. It's just perhaps in some cases it makes you more able or, you know, to exercise the social power that you have over others. But it is not the same as actually exercising free will and acting on your own rational, you know, beliefs and decisions.
Yes. So when we were coming here, we were worried that we wouldn't disagree on anything. But here, I'm going to push back, right?
Oh,
so
I go.
So I think first of all, I'd like to distinguish between two things. Firstly, are we free in the sense of morally responsible? Does moral responsibility vary with wealth? I don't think generally that it does. Right? You don't have to be very rich in order to be a rational agent in the world to an extent that makes you morally responsible for things. However, I do think that actually certain kinds of privilege do make you more free than other people. For example, if you've had the benefit of a sophisticated philosophical education, in many senses, maybe not, because lots of philosophers are very unwise, but if you're a wise person, you are, in fact, a lot freer than an unwise person, right? You better know what is good. You better know how to pursue it. You're therefore better able to act as a rational agent in the world and are, to that extent, more free. And does that mean that people who have had stable childhoods, you know, wise mentors, good access to the best that has been thought, are they more free than other people? I have to say yes, actually.
Could I just come back to that? But are we talking about making a better decision or making a decision full stop? Because, I mean, you know, I take the point that, you know, the more educated you are, the more reflective you are, you're going to make a better choice. But it doesn't mean that, you know, you have more choice, you know, just because you're going to make a better one.
Well, I would say you have a higher degree of agency, right? You, especially, so of course you could make a better choice just I wouldn't say that, for example, someone who has a better choice because he's got more people presenting him with more options is freer in that sense. But someone who has internalized virtue and has made himself wise, I think that person actually is freer than the unwise person. The unwise person is, as I said, more like a drunk, more like someone who's just stumbling through life, right? But someone who is wise and knows what is good and is able to pursue it, that person actually is more free in the relative sense. He's able to exercise rational agency.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We would love to take any questions you have afterwards, but in the meantime, can we give a big round of applause to our two guests and to yourselves?
Hi, it's Gavin.
And Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.